K versus the New Jersey State Parole Board. Can we please have appearances? Mr. Maynard, I've got your appearance even though you were muted. Go ahead.
Very much.
Next.
James H. Maynard on behalf of Appellant J.K., Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephanie Lutz on behalf of Amicus Curiae, New Jersey Office of the Public Defender.
Jane C. Schuster, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the New Jersey State Parole Board.
Thank you, counsel, and welcome. We're here, of course, the court had certain questions that we posed and you've responded. We thank you for your responses. That's the basis for the re-argument, not respectfully an opportunity to redo the case from start to finish. So to the extent possible, please try to focus your comments to us today on the import of the regulations, if any, the authority outside of explicit statutory authority and responses you may have to one another. But I do not believe we're going to need the full amount of time that everybody reserved because we've already heard a full argument on this case. Mr. Maynard, please go ahead.
Yes, as a preliminary matter, Your Honor, I feel that I need to respond to Justice LaVecchia's question in the last oral argument. And before I begin my preliminary presentation, I did review all of our briefing, and as it turns out, no, we did not raise the constitutional issue before the appellate division. I wanted to make that clear. However, this issue and the two new issues raised by the respondent have now been extensively briefed, and neither the appellant nor the respondent has made any relevant objections. Therefore, I would posit that this court may properly hear these issues. May it please the court. There are four issues at the core of this matter. First, the right of a CSL offender to return to his native country. And I would like to reserve 3 minutes, Chief Justice Rabner. I'm sorry, I would like to reserve 3 minutes. The right of a CSL offender to return to his native country, which is guaranteed by the United States Constitution, federal law, and international treaties. Second, when a CSL offender exercises the right to leave the USA, the citizens of New Jersey are better protected and the offender's rehabilitation is advanced. Third, the parole board has the authority to implement the Parole Act of 1979 under NJSA 30:4-123, quote, the board shall promulgate reasonable rules and regulations consistent with this act as may be necessary for the proper discharge of its responsibilities. Fourth, the parole board also has broad authority over conditions to be imposed or removed on offenders. Based on these four principles, JK is requesting a transfer of his residence to his home country of Poland. JK is not requesting a transfer of his supervision, which would remain with the New Jersey Division of Parole. The parole board has the capability to establish appropriate regulations for international CSL supervision. There are two types of conditions for international relocation of residents: eligibility conditions and supervision conditions. Both eligibility and supervision conditions should be designed to facilitate international relocation of residents when such relocation will foster rehabilitation and promote the safety of citizens of New Jersey. Eligibility conditions may include notarized documentation of a right of return or residence in the foreign country, availability of a place to live, and availability of employment, education, etc. Supervision conditions for a CSL supervisee living overseas must be appropriate to that context. Appropriate supervision conditions for foreign residents may include periodic verification of residence, work, etc., notice of an intent to return to the USA, and notice of new criminal charges or law enforcement contact. Eligibility or supervision conditions that create a de facto or practical bar to international relocation of residents defeat CSL's purpose of fostering rehabilitation and protecting the public and should not be permitted. Any conditions imposed by parole would be enforceable under New Jersey law. Arrest warrants for technical violations of CSL conditions would be executable on the offender's return to the US. Arrest warrants for new criminal offenses are extraditable under most foreign treaties. In any event, the parole board already allows international travel by CSL offenders and makes no objection to deportation of alien CSL offenders, reducing their supervision to zero, even though they remain on CSL. The practical reality is that once a CSL supervisee is overseas, enforcing parole conditions is no different for those who are traveling, deported, or residing in a foreign country. The parole board is capable of supervising CSL offenders living abroad. This is demonstrated by the adoption of Parole Policy 9.821, the policy, which is authorized by the Parole Act and allows the Division of Parole to modify parole conditions to comport with the context of supervision. This 26-page policy shows that the board can supervise individuals residing overseas. In fact, the policy explicitly provides for continued supervision of CSL offenders living abroad. Policy 9.821 provides a framework to implement the international transfer of residents of CSL offenders. Some modifications of the policy will be required, but that is a process of refinement that must be developed over time as the issues arise. For the reasons set forth in JK's briefing and argument, this court should reach three conclusions. First, JK enjoys a fundamental right to return to his home country. Second, the parole board has the statutory authority to develop relevant policies, such as policy 9.821. And third, any conditions restricting the international transfer of residents of a CSL supervisee must be narrowly tailored to foster the rehabilitation of the CSL supervisee and to protect the citizens of New Jersey. Thank you.
Why don't you focus your remarks, please, on the authority that the parole board had for the regulatory scheme that it adopted. We've heard from the Attorney General that it was adopted without their involvement and that they claim there is no such authority.
Well, the implementing statute itself is one of the broadest. The 30:4-123.48 is one of the broadest implementing or enabling statutes that I have seen, and it delegates a very broad authority to make both regulations consistent with the Act and as may be necessary to properly discharge its responsibilities. And also under a section of the same statute, a different section, it allows the parole board the authority over modification of conditions. So if a CSL offender, for example, went into a coma and was unable to do anything, the parole board could, under the authority delegated to it and by the enabling statutes, modify the conditions of that CSL offender's parole to virtually zero. They actually do that with deportees. The deportees are still under supervision by the Division of Parole. They can only be terminated by a Superior Court judge in a termination hearing. So they're still under supervision, but the parole board has chosen to modify the conditions of supervision to virtually zero. If a person is a stellar CSL supervisee and rehabilitates and re-enters society very successfully, there is already a four-phase process by which CSL, the Division of Parole, modifies the conditions of CSL to be less and less and less. And the frequency of visitation of a parole officer to the CSL offender's home to be less and less frequent, up to 6 months at a time without a visit. So there is already abundant usage by the Division of Parole of its broad authority to make all sorts of modifications to the conditions of supervision, and they already permit CSL supervisees to travel internationally. There is virtually no difference.
Mr. Mader, do you know, during the course of the pandemic, whether or not CSL offenders have been supervised remotely?
I don't know the answer to that question, Ron. No, in any event, there is, I think that the implementing or enabling statute that parole enjoys is the key to the authority, the legal slash statutory authority that parole needs to have. They use it robustly, and they make all sorts of accommodations and modifications for the context of various CSL supervisees. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did in fact make a modification of the during the pandemic for CSL supervisees to call in or in some way reduce the frequency of visits. I would be very surprised if that did not occur. I wish I had a concrete answer for that right now, but I don't. Perhaps the Attorney General's office might.
But how would the fact that reporting by someone in New Jersey is done virtually for a temporary period of time affect someone relocating to their country of birth? How would it bear on that? It strikes me that there's a considerable difference between the two. If there's a violation of an individual in New Jersey who misses an appointment, it seems like the remedy would be quite easily attained, not so necessarily if somebody is thousands of miles away.
I only proffer that as an example of the ability, the statutory authority of the Division of Parole to modify its conditions. Here they were met with a pandemic that caused certain necessities to change the way in which they supervise CSL supervisees, and they used their broadest statutory authority to implement various accommodations to that based on the context that they were facing. It's not a one-to-one ratio, the pandemic's modifications of conditions and what the modification of conditions would be for someone living abroad. I'm not offering it for that purpose. I'm simply saying that this is yet another of many examples of the Division of Parole exercising its statutory authority to modify conditions based on the context of the CSL supervisee.
Does the example that you gave of deportation help or hinder your argument? I'm assuming that parole is not at all a player in the decision whether an individual is deported, and they're simply responding to the reality that's thrust upon them.
I agree with that entirely. I don't think it helps or hinders my argument in the sense that I think it's just a de facto reality of how they've been handling deportations. And I don't offer that to show that they're necessarily comfortable or uncomfortable with having deportees with CSL that are still under active CSL supervision that are essentially unsupervised. I'm suggesting that this is an opportunity, this policy is an opportunity that they could in fact utilize to exert CSL supervision and become proficient with supervising CSL supervisees who have either been deported or changed residence or are traveling abroad. They could use this for all those circumstances. And before someone's deported, they could execute the various documents and procedures, and they could potentially improve their performance.
How do you respond to the Attorney General's argument or invitation that your client renounced his citizenship so he can go back to Poland?
I don't think it's fair to ask someone to renounce their citizenship to exercise a fundamental right. I don't think that that's a fair position. It's a Hobson's choice, and it simply is not necessary. We have a better methodology available to us in the parole policy that they apparently have enacted and still is in effect, has not been in any way terminated or withdrawn formally. We have an opportunity here to improve the ability of the Division of Parole to supervise CSL supervisees and offer them more of what they should be offered in reintegration in society, which is the ability to exercise fundamental rights and be in places that are foster their rehabilitation. Remember, CSL supervisees are not prisoners. They are not serving a penal aspect of a punishment like incarceration. A standard parolee is receiving a benefit by being released, but is still under the Department of Corrections, not the Division of Parole. and they are serving their punishment incarceration sentence by being on standard parole. CSL is a very different context. They are on this for life, and they are not stripped or extinguished and of their civil rights. Their fundamental rights.
Misdemeanor. I read that in your brief. We've made no distinction between parole and CSL. I know you make that argument, but we've repeatedly said that there is no distinction between the two. For double jeopardy purposes, it's a penal consequence. I know you've pressed that, but I don't know where you're going with it.
Well, the answer to that, Justice Albin, is that, and I think it's time to face this issue squarely, and I would hope that the court would do that in this opportunity or take the opportunity to do it, that CSL is just like SOMA is remedial in intent, but punitive in effect. And until and unless that contradiction is resolved, we're going to have a statute with multiple personalities. And it's going to continue to distort the application of the proper civil rights to individuals who are on CSL as if they were serving a prison sentence. You can only be on CSL if you've completed your sentence of incarceration, if you've completed your punitive sentence. You cannot be on CSL if you have not completed that punitive sentence. So it is, I believe, time to recognize, just like the Riley case did in the SOMA litigation, it is time to recognize that this statutory provision, CSL, like SOMA, is remedial in intent, but punitive in effect. And there's no contradiction there. In fact, it would resolve the bipolarity and the multiple personality issues of the CSL statute. It's a rational, coherent way of explaining what happens here when someone's on CSL. Yes, they're done their penal sentence. Their civil rights are not extinguished. The only purpose of CSL is to foster rehabilitation and protect society. Then they are expected to re-enter society and be productive citizens. So as long as we keep treating them as if CSL is incarceration, then the Division of Parole will continue to be jailers and New Jersey will continue to be a jail. But it's not. This is not the Department of Corrections. CSL has been enacted by the legislature to be under supervision of Division of Parole. So there are very, very important distinguishing characteristics between standard parole and CSL, which is supervised as if on parole, not on parole.
Anything else you'd like to add to your presentation, Mr. Maynard?
Very much, but I understand time is limited. I did preserve my 3 minutes, however.
And you'll get it.
Thank you.
Ms. Lutz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Maynard has already covered most of the issues that I was planning to address, so I'm not going to repeat those arguments, but I would like to briefly address two issues, if I may. May it please the court. The board now claims that it cannot supervise individuals abroad because it says it has no way of enforcing conditions. This is incorrect. The board's own policy states that international relocation would only be permitted to countries who have extradition treaties with the United States. The point that I want to make is that extradition actually heightens the consequences for a parole violation. Because in addition to whatever criminal penalty the person would face if they're found guilty of a violation back in New Jersey, at a minimum, they're going to be removed from their international home. They're going to be removed from their family, their job, their religious community, if they have one. So the penalty for violating a parole condition abroad is effectively greater than the penalty for violating a parole condition in New Jersey. And all of this is to say that the board can enforce conditions abroad because there are stiff penalties in place for violations, first in the form of criminal penalties and at a bare minimum in the form of extradition. The second point that I'd like to make is that at our previous oral argument in this matter, the court had asked whether the public defender sought a policy that would be subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. I want to be clear that the answer to that question is yes. If the court does order the board to adopt a policy regarding international supervision, that policy should be subject to the APA. And in fact, in the state's February 2021 brief in this matter, the board actually said that if they are ordered to adopt a policy, they would promulgate the regulations through the APA. So hopefully that answers the court's question regarding that issue. And then just finally, I wanted to address Justice Albin's question regarding supervision during the pandemic. My understanding is that at this point, parole officers are generally making in-person visits to parolees' homes. I'm not sure if they were doing that throughout the pandemic. At this point, they are. But what I can tell you, Your Honor, is that sex offender therapy programs were largely moved from in-person programs to remote programs during the pandemic. Most of my clients who were ordered to do sex offender therapy by the parole board were doing those programs remotely during the pandemic. So the board does have the power to supervise individuals through video and telephone, at least with respect to therapeutic programs. And with that, I'll be happy to answer the court's questions.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Ms. Lentz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Schuster.
May it please the court. There was nothing arbitrary or capricious about the board's denial of JK's application to relocate to Poland before or after the remand. To the contrary, the board rightly denied it in the first instance after recognizing it for what it was, a request for an early termination of JK's mandatory supervisory CSL sentence, which the board recognized was contrary to the legislature's intent and beyond its authority to order. Relying on JS, which placed mistaken reliance on Sanchez, a case which was wrong when it was decided but is more obviously wrong now, the appellate division ordered the board to consider whether there were adequate procedures that would allow it to continue to supervise JK in Poland consistent with his level of risk and the manner in which he is currently supervised. On remand, the board complied with the order to undertake that evaluation, but JK refused to give the board the information it requested, so the board again rightly denied his application. There's simply no basis for this court to find the board acted in an arbitrary or capricious way based on this record. Nothing about the policy issued by the board months after the post-remand denial of JK's application changes the analysis here. And as explained in our briefs, the policy was issued by the board in good faith, but mistakenly, without the board having realized that it lacked the statutory authority to do so. Unlike the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, who has been expressly granted by the legislature the statutory authority to approve interstate and international transfers of prisoners, the parole board has only been granted the statutory authority to approve interstate transfers of parole supervision through the interstate compact. Both the board and the court lack the authority to insert into the relevant statutes language the legislature could have intended but did not. Despite JK's and OPD's sweeping but wholly unsupported claims to the contrary, there is no federal constitutional right that requires a CSL offender to be permitted to relocate to a country where he maintains dual citizenship. For this reason, it was not surprising that our survey revealed that each state chooses how it will handle these kinds of requests, and the vast majority of states do not allow offenders to relocate internationally while serving the parole portion of their criminal sentences. Ultimately, it is up to our legislature, not this court or the board, to change the law to allow CSL and PSL offenders to relocate internationally with or without a transfer of supervision, if in its wisdom, it finds the change warranted. But as the plainly written law stands now, any such requests must be denied by the board. For these reasons and those in our brief, this court should affirm the denial of JK's application to relocate to Poland. I just would like to clarify that the board is not seeking or asking JK to give up his United States citizenship, to the extent that that conversation has come up or it's been reflected in any of our discussions, it's only in response to page 13, footnote 3 of the petitions to the petitioner's brief, which highlights that it seems to be reflecting this jealousy of non-US citizens and the fact that the board is unable to control the fact that they are deported when they're not citizens. And to the extent that he wishes to be treated like someone who's not a US citizen, he certainly has that opportunity, but the board is not seeking or asking him in any way to give up his citizenship. But again, the board does not control when people are deported. That is something that federal statutes control, and the board is not controlling that and doesn't take a position on that one way or the other. The board is not seeking to set policy. The board is simply seeking to act within the confines of its delegated authority. And the board highlights the logistical difficulties of supervision and the various jurisdictional challenges only to highlight that there are good reasons why the legislature likely elected not to create or to grant the statutory authority to allow international transfers. If this court orders or finds some authority that the board can rely on to allow for international transfers, the board will comply and will promulgate regulations. The board is just unable to find that authority. But certainly if this court can find otherwise, the board will comply. But neither neither Mr. Maynard or the OPD has pointed to any authority other than a broad statutory authority by the parole board, which is then limited by the interstate compact statute.
Well, is it limited? So typically the Attorney General's office argues for board authority under a statute. Now you're asking in this particular case for it to be limited. So we know that the statute that Mr. Maynard cited, 123.48D, is very broad. The board shall promulgate reasonable rules and regulations consistent with this act as may be necessary, .. And then for NJSA 30:4-123.49 and subparagraph C, it begins this way. And I want you to respond to this, the statutory interpretation to be given to this particular provision. It says the appropriate board panel may in writing relieve a parolee of any parole conditions. Then it's comma, and it says, and may permit a parolee to reside out of state. I'm not going to read the rest of it. So the question is a reasonable interpretation of that statute is that the first part gives very, very broad authority for a modification. And then the second part is permissive with respect to the modification to reside out of state, and then it's referring to the Uniform Act for out-of-state parole supervision. Go ahead.
Well certainly the board can change conditions, but it doesn't have the authority to unilaterally decide that it's not going to supervise anymore.
No. So what I'm asking is whether or not that provision at the comma point gives the parole board the authority to provide conditions for residents out of the country subject to supervision and all of the eligibility requirements that the parole board may require.
The reason I would say no is just because the interstate compact very specifically talks about that it's the only mechanism that can allow the movement of offenders interstate. And so when that's read together, and the reason that the legislature entered into that interstate compact about controlling movement, that everything needs to be read together, that statute and the reasoning behind that statute is set forth very clearly in 2A 168-26, where it talks about, you know, about transferring authority for the orderly and efficient manner. And it's about when people, to allow people to return back to the jurisdiction, about joint and cooperative action, promotion of public safety, that all of these things that are set forth and why the interstate compact exists, and that the legislature is very clear in its statement about that. And because there's not a counterpart that allows for international travel, I think that's significant, the same way that there is with corrections. There's a statute.
It doesn't speak to it. So I would totally agree with you. I'm not taking any firm position. If 123.49C began that the parole board does not have authority to allow someone to live outside of the jurisdiction, but may permit a parolee, that would follow. But the first part of it is just very general. And it seems that the parole board has the authority to permit international travel by parolees and CSL offenders. And where do they get that authority?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Okay. I apologize, because I think it was probably compound. I asked you a question. I probably made a remark. The first part of the statute is not written that the parole board prohibits people from living outside the jurisdiction. If it said that, it does, but may permit, then it would be clear, correct?
Well, I think it has to be read with the interstate compact, though, that specifically controls the offender movement. It can't be looked at in isolation. And to parse out a statute without looking at it in context of other authority that the legislature has either granted or taken away doesn't seem to comport with the canons of statutory construction.
So in your brief, you suggested you want to live in Poland, renounce your citizenship. And that seems to be so contrary to fostering rehabilitation in public safety. Whereas if he didn't renounce his citizenship, and it's assuming that there was a board policy and he met the eligibility requirements and there was some form of supervision and Poland has an extradition provision, that would seem to like foster rehabilitation and still promote public safety better than his renouncing his citizenship. Am I off about that?
Well, no, I mean, I think that what it comes down to is that that's a policy decision, that the legislature has made a decision about what is willing to allow and what it's not willing to allow. And I can see, after looking at the logistical difficulties of supervising someone internationally, which is why 42 states don't allow it to happen, that there's, and in fact, many don't even allow international travel, that I can see why the legislature may have elected to not allow it. Are there arguments in favor of allowing it? Perhaps, yes, but that is something for the legislature to decide, not for the parole board to decide whether or not to allow it. I only advance the arguments to point out why it's reasonable and rational for the legislature to have not elected to allow it, not that rehabilitation couldn't occur in other places. I mean, one of the things that can happen with CSL supervision is that someone can be, assuming they comply with their conditions of supervision, they can be, and they can meet the criteria for that 15-year relief valve, and a judge can find that they're not a danger to the public anymore. If you have someone who is living abroad and the parole board has very limited contact with that person and only can ensure that maybe periodically to check in that they're living in a particular location, but couldn't insist that they're complying with sex offender treatment or you know, AA or NA, things that may have reduced their their, it would allow them to sort of act more freely because they're drinking or on drugs or things like that. But if the parole board can't ensure that those things are happening, then in 15 years, someone who's just living abroad who essentially hasn't been truly supervised could say, well, I've done nothing wrong for 15 years. So now I am not a danger to the community. They can get their CSL removed and they can move back to the United States. And I could see someone in JK's position who has largely lived in the United States for most of his life and says, you know, he has connections with Poland, and that's fine, he might, but most of his life has been here. So he could go there and move back here, not having complied with anything. Again, to the extent that the legislature finds that that's appropriate, or this court finds that that's appropriate and says that the board doesn't truly have to supervise someone who lives abroad or only has to have minimal contact with them. I mean, that's certainly—
So here's my last question. And that is, if JK values his citizenship, apparently as much as he seems to, and he's in Poland, and he violates the conditions of his CSL, and then he's tried in absentia, he's not coming back, gonna be convicted of a crime, and then ICE is going to deport him, but they won't even have to do it. He'll be in Poland. Like, so what's the difference?
Well, first of all, he wouldn't be deported because he's a United States citizen. So if he came back, he's not going to be deported.
Okay.
And
you're right. The premise of my question was off. Don't even have to respond.
If he goes and is in Poland, and the board will have no way of knowing if it can't go to his home and check in on him, they would have no way of knowing if he's actually complying, particularly if there's no one to truly transfer that supervision to allow in some capacity, to allow local law enforcement, because you would never know that he was not complying, so you wouldn't violate him. So he could be doing literally anything, and as long as he's checking in and saying, yeah, I still live here, the board would have no way of knowing that he could be potentially doing all sorts of things he otherwise wouldn't be allowed to do. There'd be no check on that. One would assume that he was complying because there would be no reason or no ability to check that he wasn't, unless we're going to have parole officers potentially flying over there, or it gets transferred in some way. When someone, their supervision is transferred through the interstate compact and they just go to another state, New Jersey or any other state in the compact does not wash their hands of that person. They're serving a criminal sentence and they go back to their sending state if there's a problem. New Jersey, like any other state, when somebody is in the interstate compact, can get information about whether or not can check in to get information to ensure that their person is complying. And that receiving state in turn will let New Jersey know if something happens. And there's a whole process set up to allow them to go back and to retrieve and to work together. And internationally, it's a whole different level of complications and layers. And again, to the extent that the legislature has allows it to happen, then the board will comply. To the extent that this court finds that there's authority, the board will promulgate regulations. But it appears from the way the statutes are written that the board shall supervise, and that there's the interstate compact is the only way for adult offenders to move even interstate, and all of the policy reasons set forth in that compact, it appears that the legislature has elected not to allow this to happen, whereas they have elected to allow the Department of Corrections to allow for international transfer. So we know that the legislature knows that an international transfer is possible. Based on all of the statutes and how they speak to each other, and the fact that JK is serving parole, which is a penal part of his sentence, it appears that the legislature has essentially spoken to it by not providing a separate statute that allows for it as it has in the corrections context.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to close with, Ms. Schuster?
No, thank you. Just that the board certainly did not act in an arbitrary and capricious way, and this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Maynard, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. First, the respondent continues to conflate the transfer of residence request of JK and refer to it as a transfer of supervision. JK does not seek a transfer of supervision, only a transfer of residence. Supervision would remain with the New Jersey Division of Parole. ICAOS, the Interstate Compact, is in no way limits the Division of Parole's authority related to international transfers of residence. It's entirely silent on the issue. It has nothing to do with the international context. It was only set up to coordinate interstate issues related to offenders and their supervision. So one should not in any way impact on the other. A transfer of residence to a foreign country would not constitute a termination of CSL. That's another reference that the respondent continues to make. A termination of CSL can only occur when a Superior Court judge under the appropriate statute removes that individual from CSL by court order. So anyone that would be residing in a foreign country on CSL would remain on CSL for the rest of their life unless they came back and a court relieved them of that. And that's what happens with deportees as well. Regarding the information that was requested of JK when the matter was remanded, the Division of Parole did not request reasonable conditions or about where you would live. They requested JK provide all 23 standard CSL conditions, how they would be supervised by Polish authorities in Poland. And that was simply an impossible thing to comply with. There's no, it was a task designed to make JK's request for an international transfer fail. And it was a de facto bar. Relying on Sanchez, we determined that the board cannot ask JK to be the architect of his own supervision with impossible conditions, and that most of those conditions, in fact, had no bearing on rehabilitation or FUST or the protection of New Jersey citizens. So the request that was made for information from JK after the remand was a sweeping all 23 standard conditions of parole, how you propose and tell us how all those things would be managed. We did, in fact, we are now in possession of notarized documentation from Poland that indicates where he will live, what employment he will have, family support. We have all that, and we would be very pleased to supply it all to the Division of Parole in the process that I hope will be occurring in the near future under their policy of 9.821, which makes me wonder if all of these things were so out of reason to for the Division of Parole to consider that they had no authority, that they couldn't supervise, that anything can happen and there's no way to know what a person does internationally. Why would they have erected this 26-page policy, which frankly, I think is a very good intellectual exercise in putting together a realistic and reasonable, and I don't say that about parole much, a realistic and reasonable approach to solving this problem, which could benefit everybody. And you know what? If a person lives overseas, the citizens of New Jersey are protected from the most serious form of crime, which is physical contact offenses. And if they don't get in trouble in any manifest way, for example, they're not arrested for some violation over there, no one detects that they've been communicating inappropriately with someone in the United States, and no other issue occurs, they deserve to be relieved, just like any offender in the United States that's on CSL that may have committed offense, but has not been detected. Whether an offense is committed or not is an empirical question. And we don't know that if we don't know that. If there's no evidence to show that an offense has occurred, then that cannot be used against the speculation that an offense may have occurred just because we weren't watching them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That cannot be used to deny a CSL offender of his right of removal. And that under that scrutiny suggested by the Division of Parole, there would be no terminations or removals at all from anybody on Megan's Law or CSL. So our scheme here that we have under Megan's Law and CSL is not a scheme of absolute surveillance. It is a scheme of reasonable rehabilitation and reasonable protection of the public from reoffense.
And Mr. Maynard, if you could try to draw your argument to a close, we're
my final
we'll
point
on the 3 minutes. Go ahead.
I totally understand, Your Honor. My final point is the harmonization of between JK's civil and fundamental rights and the CSL program is the ascendant interest here. And that is what really must be achieved, just like with all of the other provisions that people on CSL or Megan's Law live under. There's always that harmonization, and we've had a large and robust body of case law from Doe v. Ports to EB to JG to even CK, if I do say so myself, that shows that there is a constant need to harmonize the interests of the civil rights of individuals subject to these lifelong programs with the rehabilitation and protection of the public. That's what these are about. These are not penal parts of an incarceration sentence. They are schemes for a remedial purpose that sometimes have punitive effects. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Maynard. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.